Dallas and Fantasy Isle, American dream, affluent style. But Robin Leach might be surprised by what I see before my eyes, watching lifestyles of the poor and nameless, sleeping on the city street. Lifestyles of the poor and nameless, begging for a bite to eat. Lifestyles of the poor and nameless, seldom seen on your TV. Lifestyles of the poor and nameless, coming soon, you and me. Spare some change, I need a bite, just to survive an awful fight. I spend my time collecting cans while you're out working on your tans, on lifestyles of the poor and nameless, begging for a bite to eat. Lifestyles of the poor and nameless, sleeping on a city street. Lifestyles of the poor and nameless, seldom seen on your TV. Lifestyles of the poor and nameless, coming soon, you and me, you and me. Now 30,000 children died, while some politician lied. They bust the starving kid who steals, while the fat cats make their sweetheart deals, on lifestyles of the poor and nameless, sleeping on a city street. Lifestyles of the poor and nameless, begging for a bite to eat. Lifestyles of the poor and nameless, seldom seen on your TV. Lifestyles of the poor and nameless, coming soon, you and me. You and me.
Robin Screech here with another thrilling episode of Lifestyles of the Poor and Nameless. Today's journey takes us to the streets of your city, where we'll visit the homeless in their native habitats, street corners of makeshift cardboard shelters, sewer grate and doorway bedrooms, soup line kitchens lit by blazing oil barrel fireplaces, alleyways of the addicted, the unemployed, the destitute, the insane, eating and sleeping in the most unlikely places. It's all here on Lifestyles of the Poor and Nameless.
Now, in the ghetto, there's always room for the ethnic population boom. The melting pot boils past the brim, while the people's future's looking grim, on lifestyles of the poor and nameless, begging for a bite to eat. Lifestyles of the poor and nameless, sleeping on a city street. Lifestyles of the poor and nameless, seldom seen on your TV. Lifestyles of the poor and nameless, coming soon, you and me, you and me. Lifestyles of the poor and nameless. Lifestyles of the poor and nameless. Lifestyles of the poor and nameless.
Lifestyles of the Poor and Nameless, Mark Levy, one of my favorite folk singers, a song which regular listeners have heard time and time again on his album Shiro's Heroes. A lot of good songs on that album, and we're going to be playing more from him and from Tom Paxton today on Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides, which is what you're listening to here at 96.3 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz. And I'm, of course, your Sunday morning into the afternoon host, 11 to 1:30. My name is Robert Norse. You can call me Bathrobes, Pierre. I wish you could call me, because we have some interesting dialogue on the air through the phone lines, but as of yet, we're still angling to get a phone line here at Free Radio Santa Cruz. If you have comments on the show, however, you can call Huff which is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, and you'll be able to leave a message of any length about this show. If you disagree, if you agree, if you think something should be said that hasn't been said, call in to 423-HUFF, H-U-F-F, or 423-4833, and let me know what you think of what you're hearing. It's really too bad that we're not able yet to draw you into the dialogue directly on the air. That's really much more, it gives us immediate input. It gives you an opportunity to really have your voice heard immediately. But until we can do that, please don't fail to use this other means, which is to call 423-HUFF, and any comments you have about the show, put them on the air, and we'll play them on Thursday. The show airs twice weekly, and there's another version, a second edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides at 6 o'clock on Thursday evening. And then we will return, of course, 11 o'clock on Sunday morning. So here we are. And we're expecting a number of things happening today. What are we expecting? Well, we're going to have some guests. Later in the show, we're going to have dead-on David Silva, who you've heard before. David is a frequent speaker at City Council, a Green Party activist, a City Council candidate, actually, in the last election, and a man who's currently suing the city, the police department, and officer Andy Crane, actually Sergeant Andy Crane, as well as one of my favorite targets and least favorite city council members, Riot Act Mike Rotkin, who you may remember I had a debate with last week on the issue of the sleeping ban. We're still working on that debate, by the way. We're going to try to have it in intelligible form. Who knows? Maybe as early as next show on Thursday. Might take us till Sunday. The tape, as I said, of the debate up at Kresge College between Mike Rotkin and myself was inaudible on the version that I taped, but I believe the videotape version, which we'll try to transfer to audio tape, is hearable, and we'll be putting that one on the air as soon as we can. And I want to thank all you who have spoken to me on the street about this debate. It's hard to say who won. I was asked today by a woman I didn't know, an older woman, whose husband was seen to be making jokes about Clinton and the local 7-Eleven, where I was stopping in to pick up some coffee right before the show. She asked me who won the debate, and I said, I don't know. The audience, according to one person in the audience, it was two-thirds applauding for me, one-third for Rotkin. But you'll be able to hear it. You'll be able to hear the volume of the audience participation. I really like audience participation. There are some who think that's anarchistic in the negative sense of the word, or chaotic, or disruptive. In fact, when the agenda is ignoring real issues, it's really important that the people set matters straight. And that's what we need, for example, more of at City Council and in all these revered chambers, these august chambers of power, where they have their agendas all laid out. The police force is ready to eject those who don't stick closely to the agenda, and you never get on the agenda because they're not interested in putting you on the agenda, those issues they regard as not issues they want to discuss, such as our favorite issue here, the sleeping ban in Santa Cruz, the anti-homeless law that makes it illegal to sleep outside after 11, that many of us are trying to change and do that by the initiative process, and City Council itself has abandoned its role. A lot of the debate last Monday was about that. We talked a lot about that at last show on Thursday, so we're not going to get into that a lot today, but there is a meeting today of the committee to repeal the sleeping ban. For those of you who want to be a part of that process, you should come to 706 Frederick Street today at 1:30 if you want to be helpful in getting these petitions out. And believe me, the committee needs your help. They are behind schedule, and they need to catch up. So 706 Frederick, and if you want more information today, give a call to call the Huff line. You probably get some information. 423-4833, 423-HUFF. And if you don't get a live voice there, and you probably won't since I'm on the air and I'm not at the Huff line, you can also try calling committee member Becky Johnson, whose phone number is 429-8529, to get information about this sleeping ban meeting. If you can't come to the meeting and you still want to volunteer, please do so, and do so soon. We need people downtown who are registered voters in the city registering other voters. And if you're not a registered voter and you don't believe in voting, I'm sympathetic. I think most of these political candidates are useless and indifferentiable and irrelevant. But on an issue like the sleeping ban, where you actually have a real choice on initiatives, for instance, I think it's important to use a wide variety of tools and weapons to deal with the current situation, and one of them is the ballot box. It isn't much, got to say that, although they talk about the sacred right to vote and all that. It's not very sacred, and it's not very effective, but in some cases it may make a difference, and here I think it will. So if you're willing just to register for this one instance, you can be homeless and register. You know, you don't need to have a mailing address. All you need to have is a place where you don't even have to be at the place that you are calling your residence. That can be a street corner. It can be the Homeless Community Resource Center at Coral Street. There are all kinds of ways to do it. So give a call to 429-8529, or if you want to give more information, you can call the voicemail for the Committee to Repeal the Sleeping Ban, which is at 457-9754, extension. This happens to me. I blank out on the extension. I will remember it later in the show. But, leave a message on the Huff line for sleeping ban information. Come to the meeting at 1:30 and give a call to Becky Johnson for live info. So we got stuff today on the air. A lot of it is about the drug war, because that seems to be heating up. There's some stuff about police violence at the state level, this scandal around the guards at different state prisons who are kind of pitting prisoners against each other. And we're going to hear some clips from our own city council debate and discussion with the public around homeless issues and the issue of Happy John Dine. Happy John, as you know, is the man who was shot dead on November 12th by the police at Front and Soquel Streets, allegedly for brandishing a toy weapon. Officer Carey shot him. Officer Over was there. Ben Newman, the Catalyst bouncer, was in the back seat of the car, and the case went through the police review board, and they found that everything was hunky-dory, that the original story, which fell apart, that the police chief and the DA originally had, that the Dine was pointing a weapon, waving it, combat stance, threatening behavior, was shown to be, was contradicted by all the other witnesses, so they came up with a second story, the Citizens Police Review Board, and that story is the one that the City Council gave its stamp of approval to. We've talked about this again at past shows, and there's not a lot new that's going on this. There's a few new elements. For instance, I talked to a homeless man who told me that he had lunch with Happy John the day that Happy John was shot. And he said John wasn't carrying a toy weapon. He may have had one in his pack, but he had in his hand a small black radio. So there's a bit of interesting information. And other people actually have said that in the course of investigation that we've done. We haven't really pressed that point because the toy gun was found by his side. But there is a real question as to whether an officer didn't open his backpack, Officer Over, and throw it to the ground after the shooting had actually happened. So it's a real question, which, of course, the Citizens Police Review Board did not examine. It took on faith the testimony of the police officers because they were, quote, closest and had the best vantage point. That, of course, is, I think, of questionable validity, given the fact that they're also the individuals who are most culpable in that situation and have the most interest in presenting a story that exonerates them. But that has been accepted by the City Council. I guess the next City Council or the one after, that Police Chief Steve Belcher will be showing up again. And we're going to have a report on, procedures for dealing with the mentally ill, and maybe for dealing with the press. It's not entirely clear to me. Some sort of brief follow-up report. And I also heard that there's going to be a picketing of the Police Review Board, the Citizens Police Review Board, and a literature distribution. And one guy is so concerned about this, he's going to actually sponsor a picket in front of the Police Review Board. So we're actually looking for someone who's interested in that job. Apparently minimum wage will be paid for anyone who wants to do that. And if you're interested in picketing the Police Review Board and its decision to exonerate the police chief, the officers involved in the killing of Happy John Dine, the disabled man who was shot dead for brandishing a toy gun in November, two shots to the belly, give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833. With that, maybe we should do is let's pick up where we left off at the last show. Last show, we were playing an interview with a woman named Turtle, who is on the Santa Cruzans for Full Disclosure, a committee concerned with exposing the inconsistencies and contradictions in this case, the case of the killing of Happy John Dine. And she and her companion Bam Bam, who's a drummer and a fellow who's been leading recently the concerns to keep the Happy John inquiry open, had a report on Officer Martin Over. Martin Over was the companion officer, the partner of Officer Connor Carey, the man who killed Happy John Dine. Over has a very bad reputation on the mall as a individual who harasses the homeless, street jewelers, harasses poor people who are sitting down, youth, sort of throws his weight around in order to remove the economically non-conforming or those who don't have large checkbooks, don't look like the standard middle-class folks. Kind of move them along, which of course is not simply that he's a rogue cop. This is part of the program of the Downtown Association to get the homeless people out of sight, if not out of town, certainly out of the downtown, and that's part of their deal. If you read their new Real Change, Not Spare Change business card, slip of paper, it's now not a yellow paper, by the way, it's a little blue slip of paper that's designed to discourage tourists from giving away money to panhandlers. They have some new numbers listed as to where people can go for food services. They actually, these numbers are somewhat more accurate than the last piece of paper that came out a year ago. It was a complete joke. And I remember a spokesinger and activist Phil Free was out there on the mall vigorously protesting the this kind of throw a little, let them eat paper campaign, which the city and the mayor, then Mayor Cynthia Matthews, and the police chief and the district attorney were all kind of touting. This is not just happening in our city. This is a kind of a nationwide, I think there's a nationwide think tank that gives these gross ideas, sends them out for anti-homeless laws and anti-homeless policies by downtown associations so that they can kind of wash their hands of the reality of the economic problems of our times and just sort of do their business as usual, preferably, in their view, privatizing as much of the area as possible, extending their little shops out onto the street so they can do their selling, but driving away poor people, for instance, who want to sell their jewelry, who want to sell their small handcrafted items, who aren't in any way a real competitive threat. But just a very kind of mean-spirited kind of approach is happening here. Anyway, this Real Change, Not Spare Change program is the Downtown Association's attempt to say, don't bother to give them any money, just throw a slip of paper at them that says, go to the shelter, go to the food services. Otherwise, they'll just spend it on drugs, you know, things of that sort. In fact, we pointed out there the numbers were wrong. The shelters, there's no shelter space. The rhetoric was vicious. It was a bad cart. They've cleaned it up a little, but it's still pretty bad. And you can see, for instance, that they don't list Food Not Bombs, and they don't list Feed the People. These are two actually grassroots organizations that were feeding homeless people. Food Not Bombs still is. Every Wednesday and Thursday at the town clock, I believe it's at 4. It may now be at 5. I'm not quite sure if they've changed their time. And every Saturday and Sunday at 1 at the town clock. And they actually moved out of the downtown area from Cathcart and Pacific, where they were feeding, in an attempt to placate the merchants and feed the people, an organization led by a number of people, Shavy, Sean Alimi, Shitkicker Sean, as I call him, Pepper Spray Pat Ring at one time, or I guess it was Pepper Tongue Pat Ring when he was in town. That fed downtown. None of these are mentioned. The Elm Street Mission is mentioned because that's considered nice and close. People get off the streets and they're not visibly eating at a soup line, which is, of course, a dead giveaway that things aren't too well in our downtown scene, so that's something that the merchants can support an indoor church that's off the main drag. But if you try to feed people in front of their shops, they start having coronaries and getting the police to engage in these anti-homeless policies and the city council to pass anti-homeless laws, which is what unfortunately we have now. And a word about Sean Alimi. He, as you may have heard, was jailed again for under a series of so-called drug crimes. He was accused of providing marijuana and methadrine to minors, and also inappropriate sexual behavior with minors. And this these allegations, I haven't met many people who believe them. I don't believe them. I know that he was jailed for another 7 months a couple years ago on similar so-called drug charges. But the main complaint, it seemed, that most merchants had against him and most the authorities was that he was visibly the head of the feeding program downtown that wouldn't go away. And he's also quite extroverted and outspoken in his views, and he really is quite friendly toward the police, which has raised a few eyebrows in the activist community. But apparently that's not good enough for the police and the merchants, because it looks like they've hauled him off to jail on the questionable testimony of a couple of minors who apparently have a history of drug charges themselves, and it's hard to say what's going on. His next hearing, for those who are interested, is February 13th. I'm sorry, March 13th. We're already in March, aren't we? March 1st. Wow. March 13th in Department 1 at 8:15, for those of you who want to go on this Friday the 13th hearing, for Sean Alimi and his situation. He is at liberty, but he is now being forced, he feels, to take a low profile. He's not doing his feeding program, because if he's arrested for anything, he'll be jailed, which will cut into his ability to defend himself against, I think it's, has had 14 to 16 felonies they're charging him with. Sounds a little similar to what happened to Keith McHenry, the Food Not Bombs activist in San Francisco back in 1994, when McHenry was charged with stealing milk crates, or felony possession of milk crates, and other spurious charges. So, that's it. You're kind of getting the preliminary update here. It's Free Radio Santa Cruz you're listening to, in case you've forgotten, 96.3 FM on your dial. We're a station that caters to you. We don't care how outspoken you are. If you've got an announcement you want to put on the air, we're interested in hearing it if it has some benefit to the community. We don't insist you be politically correct. We don't insist you sanitize your language. You don't have to say fuck every third word either. But hey, speak your mind, and even if it causes consternation. The voicemail for Free Radio, if you want to leave an announcement to put on the air, is 427-4523. It's again 427-4523. If you are an internet man or woman, your Free Radio Santa Cruz address there is FRSC, Free Radio Santa Cruz, at cruzio.com. Again, FRSC at cruzio.com. Post office box 7507 Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Send us your PSAs, your loop tapes, and your demos. If you're looking for a show on the air, we would like to help you. I'm not quite sure how full the schedule is, but there may always be room for another if you've got stuff that looks good. So 427-4523, let us know that you're out there listening, and let us know what you want put on the air. Another announcement. There is a candlelight vigil, I think, still going on, although it's not clear. I guess this was before Clinton did his switch in time on the Iraq situation. 5:30 to 6 at the town clock, I believe there's still a nonviolent vigil to urge a nonviolent resolution to the crisis with Iraq. And for more information on that, you can give a call to the Resource Center for Nonviolence, 423-1626. And while I'm talking about the Resource Center for Nonviolence, here's a tip of the hat to a man I've had not too much good to say about in the past, Resource Center worker Doug Rand. Doug and I have often been at loggerheads on different issues. I've been on the opposite side of him on a number of occasions, but I want to thank him for his outspoken support for the Pelton Street Garden Project, retaining that property so the Garden Project has a chance to continue. His voice was heard at City Council from the audience. I was very impressed that he was quite angry at the City Council's sellout on this issue. And I hope I'm not misquoting him on this. I think it's good when Resource Center for Nonviolence folks wake up and actually join the community on vibrant, important issues, and even if it means abandoning a few of the respectable political contacts that have gotten them some prestige and comfort in the past. And I think that I just want to thank Doug for speaking up on that issue, and also speaking up on the issue of the police grant to the Resource Center for Nonviolence, which a lot of us are just shaking our heads about. money going to the resource center from the police department that supposedly Eric Larson tells us will not make the resource center beholden to the police department. That's an interesting theory. We'll see if it works. I don't think Doug thinks it works, and I certainly don't think it works. Well, let's go directly into... What are we going directly into? Officer Over. I was talking about Officer Over's bad behavior on the mall, and then I kind of got side-trained into the downtown ordinances and the real change, not spare change, phony, let them eat paper campaign. But here's a conversation, a report on Officer Over that we began to hear at the last show, and now we're going to complete. Here with Bam Bam and Turtle Turtle. You say you had some observations on Officer Over.
Yes, today, let's see, today is January the 20th. That's
January
the end
27th.
Of that one.
Yes, go ahead. And what did you notice about Over?
Oh, well, about Over in particular or the situation?
Tell me about the situation.
All right, I will. Oh, it's a homeless brother. I forget his name, but I'll give it to you at a later date.
Right.
He's been around for many, many years, and every day he comes every morning carrying his entire pack with him, and carries him and keeps it all day long because he has no place to be and has no place to put his pack. Anyhow, he put his pack down in front of Santa Cruz Roasting Company, went in, got a cup of coffee, came back out, and the officers were there. And...
Officer Over among them?
Officer Over, as well as two other... One other officer, probably one in blue and black uniform, the other one in slightly, in like, riot gear uniform type energy. Actually, it was riot gear.
It was a menacing pack.
Menacing, very menacing pack. Anyhow, so Officer Over demanded that... the brother pick it up and move along. He can't keep it there. And the homeless brother stood strong and said, you know, he demanded that he was a person just like everybody else, and he put it there for a minute, and it's his stuff, and he went to go get a cup of coffee just like any other consumer, you know, and he had a right to be there. And so Officer Over, while the brother was preparing his coffee, he opened a sugar packet, and the top that he ripped off while he was talking fell on the ground, and Officer Over proceeded to give him a ticket for littering. So of course that enraged him, as this homeless brother is easy to enrage because he's been harassed many, 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 many times. So things started going on, in which case he started getting loud and telling Officer Over that he couldn't move him anywhere. He'll be wherever he goddamn wants to be. You know, he's a citizen. He's not hurt anyone. A free man, yes, sir. Anyhow. In which case, Officer Over called his sergeant and proceeded to give him another ticket for littering.
Second ticket for littering?
Yes, he did. Because he proceeded to roll a cigarette, in which case one of the cigarette wrappers fell to the ground. I mean,
uh-huh.
this homeless brother was so enraged. He was not aware, you know, where what he was doing, and Officer Over was
having
basically...
Time, eh?
Would you let me finish?
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Yes.
Which Officer Over was clearly aggravating the situation, just and really aggravating
it. That's one of our police officers you're talking about.
You know, well, I know, but you know, they're humans first, and humans have a tendency to fall into their ego when it becomes something that comes close to their heart. Anyhow, so at the end, the sergeant came and. In which case...
Sergeant who?
Officer Over's sergeant.
Man or woman?
Man.
Mm-hmm.
He was standing right
sergeant
here.
Sergeant Vogel.
Right there. Sergeant Vogel. In which case, before the sergeant came there, Officer Over was demanding that this man not smoke, telling him if he so much as lit it, he was going to haul him away.
He was concerned about his health.
Yes. Very, 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 very concerned. I think more appropriately, he was more concerned about his own health.
Officer Over is to be commended for his assiduous behavior.
In which case, I understand that, you know, if he doesn't want smoke around him, but to haul his ass off because he lit a cigarette is a little, you know, a little overdone. Anyhow.
Overdone, well put.
So, the sergeant came, in which case Officer Over became much more patient, much more polite. I want to point out that the other two officers that were there at this time were very respectful, they were very polite, they were relaxed and very, very patient with the situation. You know, Officer Over
did
was
not. Did he end
up
getting two tickets?
Yeah, he did.
Thank you very much, Turtle.
Okay.
Keep up the good work. What time of day was this?
My real name's Kimberly Reyes.
And KR, keep up the good work.
Okay, let me tell you what time of day this was. This was around, let's see, I would guess, definitely...
Morning or evening?
Oh, 1:30, 2 o'clock.
Thank you very much. And that was a report on Officer Over, one instance of his recent behavior. That was back in late January. Now it's again returned to, I guess it's late January, for a... No, actually, it is. It's a speech at City Council and some discussion around homeless issues there.
Anybody would like to speak to us on something that's not on our agenda, this is the time to do so.
My name is David Silva, 144 Belmont Street. I'm the outreach coordinator for the Committee to Repeal the Sleeping Ban, as it's referred to. Basically, what we've done is we've created an initiative to excise from the current camping ordinance those human rights violations that make sleeping in itself a crime and any criminalization of sleeping. We're asking, of course, for all of your support, and we'll be appealing to you directly, personally, from the heart, as often as possible, until we have your support. We have been on the streets, and we do have support of the people. There's no doubt that this is going to pass. So I just sort of say it's time for you to do a little mind shift. This is going to pass. The thing that we've been facing, of course, is the confusion between the camping ordinance and this sleeping section of the camping ordinance, the sleeping ban. We've challenged that each time it's come up. But most recently, the assistant chief of police, and I'm sorry that I haven't talked to him personally today about it, was interviewed, and it seems that the police department is taking the position that their opposition to this will be that it creates litter. Well, a repeal of a camping ordinance would create litter, because camping, just of necessity itself, does create what can become litter. But sleeping, other than drool, does not create litter. And so let us be very clear that we're talking about just that human rights violation of the camping ban. And let's try to keep this debate on point. And it's going to be a debate about bringing a little bit of heart back to Santa Cruz. And it's going to be a debate about taking away a law that is a bad law, that bad law makes bad cops, and police shouldn't be required to behave and to do this, to enforce this kind of thing. So I just apologize for that assistant chief of police for not having talked to him personally, and I intend to talk to him and explain to him exactly what it is we're doing. Also, I'm sure that the beach area business association will be glad to know that we've excluded that and all the residential areas and all the beachfront areas from direct application of this. It will be up to the city council to regulate sleep in those areas. But that regulation of sleep will not ever result in a misdemeanor or criminalization for sleep in and of itself. I hope I've explained it, I'm waiting for your calls, and please talk to me. Please know that we did a best job as we could of looking at the history of how this came about and trying to rectify what is really a human rights violation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Malcolm Murphy, and I'm with the Tenants' Rights Union. I talked to some of you who have phoned recently. We're trying to get a storefront for the Tenants' Rights Union. The county's been real gracious about offering us this property on Water Street. And what we need to do is get a special use permit, but to get a special use permit, we need a waiver because we don't have $1,000. Because we're a Tenants' Rights Union, we don't have much money at this point. We've helped over 400 people with the unlawful detainers since May of 97. We plan to help about 500 people in that way every year. We would like to get the waiver. I know there's a process that has to happen before the waiver can go through. I know the waivers are really rare and that we're asking for a very special favor. Now, renters do make up a large majority, not majority, but almost 40% of the population. And we do deserve a shingle in this town, in this county. And so the county really wants to give us this place. They already given us a price. They're ready to sign a lease. All we need is the waiver. And they're willing to match the waiver, of course, with 4 months free rent. And I think that's really gracious on that part. They're really working hard to make this happen for us. So I'm hoping that this can happen at maybe, I assume the process would be at another city council meeting, maybe the next one, where you can vote on whether or not we get the waiver. And then I understand that after we get the waiver, then the application process actually begins for deciding what kind of special use we have for it. So I just want to keep it before the city council, and hopefully we can make some more progress. I think it's going pretty quick so far, and I really appreciate all the help and input and advocacy that's displayed on your part for us. Thank you.
Thank you. Tenants are 53% of the tenants are 53% of people who live in the city center.
We've been in contact on this matter and we're pursuing possibly next. Thank you. Is there anybody else who wishes to speak in oral communications? Please come forward.
Council members, my name is Robert Norris. I work for a group called HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. Late last month, authorities dropped charges against Patricia Gardella, a portly homeless woman who can be seen often outside the county courthouse. She was also a frequent fixture at the Metro bus stop at Ocean and Water Streets with a cart full of her worldly goods. You won't see her there anymore. A discriminating Metro driver decided that she sat too long at that bench and called the police. Ms. Gardella had an all-day pass, but that apparently wasn't good enough for this driver. He made a citizen's arrest for trespass, giving Ms. Gardella a trespass ticket and directing her to move on. Ms. Gardella caught the ear of a friendly attorney who took the matter to court. The Metro Transit Authority caved in and asked the charge be dismissed. Judge Kelly pointed out the city ordinance used mandates procedure for issuing the trespass ticket. It requires a written withdrawal of consent by the Metro. Ms. Gardella faced a bogus $135 ticket. But who will ticket the Metro and the police for dragging her into court improperly? This practice of harassing, citing, and frequently incarcerating the poor for unsightly or is it unprofitable conduct in public spaces was a favorite of officers arresting the homeless for sleeping outside during the City Hall sleepers protest. Now, we might write off Gardella's mistreatment to overzealous behavior by a driver, perhaps followed by officious behavior from a manager, but a week later, lo and behold, the bench where Ms. Gardella often could be found sitting has itself disappeared. When I called the Metro Transit Authority this afternoon, on whose board Councilmember Rutkin sits, I was told without apology or excuse that, yes, the bench had been removed because they had a problem with a homeless person. That's the word they used, homeless. Not mentally disabled, not developmentally disabled, bum, or violent toy gun wielder. No, this time I got the straight story. The target was a homeless woman. This, like the downtown ordinances, like the sleeping ban, like the killing and cover-up of Happy John Dine, is a civil rights issue. Councilmember Rotkin accrues Santa Cruz as a full disclosure for crying wolf when we denounced the Belcher Danner cover-up, about which more later. But who are the real wolves? Are they not some very familiar council members elected in sheep's clothing? Are they not the amiable and somewhat arrogant wolves who turned on their constituents and tried to eat up Grandma Celia Scott before dozens of angry Red Riding Hoods shaking their scanned membership cards flooded this chamber to drive them back? You know, damned if I don't recognize these same well-spoken wolves as the pack preparing to make a meal of the beach flats, leaving the choicest cuts for the Seaside Company. Friends of Happy John Dine report that he was driven from the Metro Transit Center as he was in front of the Catalyst weeks before he died. It was perhaps fitting that at a Metro bus stop he received his final citation from the police force that had harassed him on the mall. Those of us who tried to use the buses... those that are still running, ask this council to look into securing the rights of poor people with bus passes in hand to use them without being arrested by our so-called public servants. Perhaps Mike Rodkin could take time out from bashing homeless activists, criminalizing the poor along the river, trashing the public on the Horner Starter Project, to rein in
water law
metro abuses. I'm finished.
Right.
Thank you.
Robert, could you give me...
Patricia Gardella, G-A-R-D-E-L-L-A, and I can also give you the attorney who represented her, but I prefer to do that off mic. I'll call you on that issue.
Oh, that's all right. I just wanted to know the name.
Sure. Thank you.
And that was me and David Silva and Marco Moroni of the Tenants' Rights Union of Santa Cruz, whom you heard on this show on Thursday, talking to City Council in late January. By the way, the bench on which Patricia Gardella was sitting, on which she was ticketed, and which was taken by the Metro in order to discourage her from sitting there, has returned to Front and Soquel. I'm sorry, not Front and Soquel, Water and Ocean Street, but I don't know if she has returned. I think they are now, it's been locked to a pole for some reason with a big chain, if that makes any difference. Well, musical break, and we'll continue with more from this City Council meeting.
Was stopping one innocent afternoon for paper and magazine. My attention was drawn to a riot of color, the loveliest I've ever seen. All in the shape of a plastic cube, red and yellow and blue. How lovely, I cried, with a clever design. Pray tell me, sir, what does it do? That's easy, he said, as he handled my cash and he dropped the cube into a sack. Some of the colors you twist left or right, some you twist forward, some back. Before very long, if you're clever at this, you've got all the colors the same. And then if you like, you start over again, for it's fun and it's only a game. Only a game, only a game, I'm muttering under my breath. Only a game, only a game, like dying is only death. I talk to myself as I walk down the street, till old friends all cry with a shame. For he used to say hello and how do you do, all he says now is only a game. That night after dinner I settled myself, planning to watch some TV. Safe in the warmth of my favorite chair and the bosom of my family. Basking in fellowship, brimful of cheer, I bade my child turn on the tube. And as I was watching my favorite show, I carelessly picked up the cue. I twiddled it this way, I twiddled it that. Ha ha, I exclaimed, this is strange. No matter how often I twiddle this cube, the blasted thing don't seem to change. I felt myself growing the slightest bit warm as I twisted and whirled and spun. They tell me they found me there early next morn. I was screaming, my God, dearly done. For it's only a game, only a game, I'm muttering under my breath. Only a game, only a game, like dying is only death. I talk to myself as I walk down the street, till old friends all cry with shame. For he used to say hello and how do you do, all he says now is only a game. Somehow I got dressed and they drove me to work, and I slowly came out of my haze. By a fierce act of will I sat down to my task. There was talk I might soon earn a raise. The boss called me into his office at 10, and he said to me, glad that you came, for I'm thinking of adding this toy to our line, for it's fun and it's only a game. Well, I don't know what happened, I don't want to know. I'll have all my life to repent. They say I did something with that little cube that the boss was obliged to resent. And now I get visitors here in my room, and they murmur, poor man, what a shame. For he's twisting his ears, and he's twiddling his nose, and he tells us it's only a game. Only a game, only a game, I'm muttering under my breath. Only a game, only a game, like dying is only death. I talk to myself as I walk down the street, till old friends all cry, what a shame. For he used to say hello and how do you do, all he says now is only a game.
And that, of course, was Tom Paxton from his 1983 tape Bulletin, Only a Game. We're going to be hearing more from Tom as the show proceeds. You, of course, are tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. And I'm your host, Bathrobes Pierre Robert Norris, for, well, the next hour and a half at least, maybe a little longer, until 1:30. We'll be getting some guests in soon on this edition of Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides, Civil Rights for Poor Folks in Santa Cruz, Indoors and Outdoors. I'm looking at an issue of the Anderson Valley Advertiser, a weekly newspaper out of Boonville, California, which you can pick up at the Book Loft here on the east side next to the Rio Theater. I would also say you could pick it up at the Java House and the Bookshop Santa Cruz, but those are two... phonetic spelling of his name. He has an interesting bit on TB, and I want to read it to you because it relates to folks who are poor. When my son tested positive for TB, an affliction that I thought had been banished roughly when Upton Sinclair wrote The Jungle or Lincoln Steffens proclaimed the shame of the cities, I resolved to do some unsmiling research. I found that as of the latest annual federal figures in March of 1997, TB cases in Washington had increased by 36% as against a decline of 7% in the United States as a whole. Let's disregard the somewhat distasteful way that, I'm skipping here a bit, get to the main event, which is an amazed discovery that TB wasn't eradicated 60 years ago. This is very odd. The recrudescence of TB in the inner cities was a big story in the mid-Reagan years and returned to the headlines again some 4 years ago. Back in 1994, I talked to a friend of mine, Tom Frieden, director of the New York Bureau of TB Control, who put it simply enough. TB is a window. It reflects social conditions, crowding, prisons, homeless shelters. In 1994, the Census Bureau reported that the number of Americans in poverty had increased to 39.3 million. The 80s trend towards greater inequality continues. Even Robert Reich, Secretary of Labor, conceded that we have the most unequal distribution of income of any industrial nation in the world. TB nearly tripled in New York between 1978 and 1992. The city had about three times as many cases as any other big center and between four and five times the national average. The rate for Central Harlem was 220 per 100,000, as opposed to 12 in Forest Hills, Queens, 50 citywide, and 10 per 100,000 across the country. The most important factor in the epidemic was HIV. In areas where TB had never been eradicated, i.e. Harlem, not the West Village. Another major factor was immigration, particularly from Haiti, the Dominican Republic, and China. TB remains what it has been for over a century, the leading infectious cause of death worldwide, narrowly ahead of malaria and measles. Decline in the public health infrastructure was similarly complicit. In the mid-60s, New York had over 1,000 beds for TB patients. By 1994, less than 100. Clinics fell from 24 to 10. Much of this unraveling could be traced to Nixon's switch from categorical federal funding, use this money to buy TB beds, to block grants for states, where the lobby for TB-ridden indigents was not large. And, of course, TB flourished in the burgeoning homeless shelters, decrepit tenements, and crowded jails associated with post-72 and more so post-80 American cities. With TB, treatment is prevention. Ensure a patient completes antibiotic therapy and there is one less carrier. Cure all the carriers and you wipe out the disease. So Frieden concentrated on observed therapy and tracing patient contacts. Between 1992 and 1993, after a jump in funding, the epidemic began to ebb, with cases dropping from 3,811 to 3,245. From epidemics, asthma is now a huge problem of mysterious cause. Friedan turned to a second major topic in the relationship between health and decline, access to health care and the concomitant inverse care law, those who need it most get it least. As Friedan pointed out, many of the preoccupations of the healthcare industry are fairly useless. Friedan offered what he called a structural category concerning illness and class, of which the prime example is smoking, number one cause of preventable disease and death in the U.S., cancer, heart disease, emphysema, and closely correlated with socioeconomic status. The poor smoke more, and the tobacco companies target them, just as they target women and young people in the third world, where, because of the preponderance of young populations, a tobacco-related holocaust looms in the early to mid-21st century. And then there's talk about another structural factor is lead, a major mediator of social class in terms of inhibiting learning ability and overall mental function. Friedan's final category of prime concern was drug resistance. People are dying from infections that are incurable by antibiotics or only curable by antibiotics that are enormously expensive. Normal TB vaccines, isoniazid and rifampin, cost from $400 to $2,500 for a course of effective treatment, costing from $50,000 to $500,000. Anyway, this is, to me, an interesting statement on TB, because I think this was a concern that we have here, even here in Santa Cruz. I'm looking to get some stats on TB in the shelters and TB in the armory. And it's one of the reasons people don't use the armory, is their fear of picking up this kind of infectious disease. So I'm kind of straying a little from my usual back lot here around the sleeping ban and police concerns, mainly because I found some articles I found really interesting and I wanted to share with you. Here's another one from the Anderson Valley Advertiser, again from the February 18th issue, A Short History of Dope in America. By 1873, dope was dotting the American landscape as a legion of Civil War amputees and bullet-ridden veterans tanked up on various opiates to ease their sorrow. Morphine was isolated from opium by German pharmacist F.W. Stirner in 1805, and by the 1830s, Britain, Germany, and the United States were producing big quantities to ease pain, soothe a cough, and make childbirth dreamy. Our forebears were consuming more opiates than we can imagine today, which resulted in a nation of 76 million souls having 350,000 junkies by 1899, twice the current rate of addiction and the highest in American history. About the same time, the very diligent Germans whipped out a new cough suppressant and named it heroin. The shortages during World War II drove them to create a synthetic heroin called methadone. The dope could be had from any drugstore or doctor, but addiction was seen as shameful in a nation that worshipped self-reliance. Eugene O'Neill forbade production of his monster play about his mother's habit, Long Day's Journey into Night, during his lifetime. William Stuart Halstead, the king of surgery at Johns Hopkins, was a stone-cold junkie for decades, but this information was kept secret by his drug dealer, the renowned Dr. Sir William Osler, and became known only with the publication of Osler's diary in 1969. A lot of fuss about the vast gobbling of opiates was avoided by the simple fact that patent medicine companies were major newspaper advertisers who universally signed contracts stipulating that if any state restricted their products, they would jerk all their newspaper ads, a practice that sedated a generation or two of American newspaper editors. This wonderland for junkies was ruined during World War I. There have been sputtering attempts in the U.S. to outlaw the smoking of opium, a practice feared lest the heathen Chinese swarm out of their warrens and enslave white women. This would be a recurring habit for American lawmakers. Later, Southern support for suppression of cocaine was sought by pointing out how Southern blacks could get inflamed, swarm out of their shacks, and ravage white women. American narcotics thinking has always functioned by talking about them. The Harrison Act of 1914 heavily restricted access to opiates and was passed in the same general high spirits that led cities across the country to shut down red light districts to save our warriors from the clap, and that led our nation finally to abolish booze. And then in the 30s came that American film classic Reefer Madness. In the following decades, cocaine and marijuana landed outside the pale until we arrived at our present state of affairs, in which we generate at least half the world's dope business, and we have cops everywhere to stop us. Since then, we have had epidemics, especially of heroin, which means a bunch of people drop dead, and for a brief while, we must notice what we do to ourselves. Every year since 1988, heroin has suddenly come back is always of a new astonishing purity and winds up killing people. Right now, heroin on the street is running from 40 to 90% pure, which means you can afford to snort it and not use a needle. This attraction has wooed movie people and models and brought bleats from the president about heroin chic. The DEA has evidence that suggests that Colombian and Mexican cartels are targeting nice communities for all the same reasons other merchants do. The money to buy the product, a virgin market, lack of regulation, cops used to barking dog complaints, not drug dealers, and a global oversupply. Like the auto industry, the world's heroin labs suffer from overproduction. And with growing global free trade, borders are porous and the drive for new customers is relentless, which is how heroin winds up in the veins of someone like a 19-year-old Marine home on leave, or a 16-year-old cheerleader, or anyone at all. That's a story, A Short History of Dope in America, by Charles Bowden in the Anderson Valley Advertiser. Well, you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, as you probably know, and I think our first guest has just about arrived. We're going to be talking to her in a moment. Until then, however, check this out.
I used to love to hear the rain come down. It used to whisper on my window. I'd lie awake and listen, half asleep I'd murmur, got to love this rain in Iowa. I used to welcome every drop of rain, it came as manna to my garden. And in the sunny morning, I'd walk among the flowers, they used to look like they were on the raid. But now we're living on some suffering ground. The flowers withered and the grass turned brown. And now I'm praying when the rain comes down, the facts begin to be plain. And now we're looking at a desperate year. On many faces there are traces of fear. Because it's raining and it's terribly clear. Unless I'm going insane, there's something wrong with the rain.
And another song from Tom Paxton, Bulletin, There's Something Wrong with the Rain. Well, in the studio with us now, we have a homeless activist who's been doing a lot of writing lately, who's on the board of the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, who's a producer of television shows, and has recently been working on a memorial, an encomium, to a woman who was part of the homeless protest at the City Hall, the City Hall Sleepers Vigil, the City Hall Sleepers protest back in 1996, 2 years ago, a protest that lasted, as I said, for over 7.5 months, over 350 tickets and arrests, peaceful all of them, but really a blot on our city who refused to consider real changes in the sleeping ban law, which is why we're now fighting to put this matter before the voters in November. But we recently lost a homeless activist, and here is Becky Johnson to tell us about it.
Thank you, Robert. Many of our Free Radio listeners remember Tama Perlman from the City Hall Sleepers protest. She spent many weeks, even months there, and she was homeless and pregnant and vigiling and seeking services here in Santa Cruz as a pregnant homeless woman. On January 23rd, Tama, who is no longer homeless and the mother of a one-year-old baby, suffered a burst brain aneurysm, and she was rushed to Dominican Hospital. She died on January 27th at the age of 24 years old, mother of a one-year-old child. it was a very unexpected, and the community is really in shock and grief-stricken over this. I wanted to tell you a little bit about Tama's life. She was born in August 16th, 1973. When she was only 2 years old, her father, Dan Cooper, was forced to give her up for adoption. He was pressured into it. And so she did not see her father again for many years. She saw him briefly when she was 14, but mostly she grew up in Southern California with her mother and a family. She was of Japanese descent on the mother's side. Tama became homeless when she was hitchhiking with her boyfriend up en route to Seattle, and something went awry. Her boyfriend left her in Santa Cruz, and she remained in Santa Cruz until her death, spending much of that time homeless. She would occasionally find some place to stay or someone's couch, but she never really found permanent housing in that way. At age 8, Tama had learned that her father, that her biological father was alive and that he was an activist, and that made an impression on her. When she was in Santa Cruz, she joined the vigil at City Hall as part of the City Hall sleepers protest in 1996. Tama experienced some problems with the Child Protective Services. I wrote an article about this, which appeared in the March 1997 issue of Street Spirit. The article was called "The Lost Children of the Poor," and I'm going to read for you from that article the story of Tama's encounters with Child Protective Services as a result of having given birth after a long period of homelessness. Tama Pearlman and her fiancé Gideon, whose portrait appeared on the cover of the October 1996 Street Spirit when Tama was pregnant, gave birth to a healthy, beautiful baby girl on January 13, 1997 at Dominican Hospital. Perhaps because Tama had been homeless for much of her pregnancy, she had been repeatedly tested for drug use at all 8 of her prenatal visits through the Santa Cruz County Health Services Agency. All 8 tests were negative. At the birth, Tama and her newborn daughter were again tested for drugs. Both tests came up negative. Yet 24 hours after giving birth, J.M. Rodriguez of Santa Cruz Child Protective Services arrived at the hospital with a uniformed sheriff's deputy to take Tama's baby into protective custody because the baby was, quote, exhibiting symptoms of withdrawal, unquote. It was a shock, Tama said. I just had a baby. I was really exhausted. It was like I was in a dream, a nightmare. There was some evidence of fetal distress at the birth as meconium was present. The staff told Tama they needed to clean the baby up in the nursery, and Tama gave her consent. Tama had told the labor nurse she intended to breastfeed her baby, yet after the birth, the nursing staff fed the baby a soy-based formula. Ruth Heibarger, an active member of the La Leche League, comments, quote, because meconium was present at the birth, indicating some distress, it is all the more reason why the child should have been offered the breast early on. It is so typical of hospitals to completely disregard the wishes of the parent regarding his or her expressed desire to nurse their child. Early nursing is critical for the mother and the baby for both physical and emotional reasons. As a woman using Medi-Cal, Tama's choices were even more limited. As all the later events revealed, Tama's daughter had suffered an allergic reaction to the soy formula, which Dominican personnel Dr. Lenz, and CPS dubbed symptoms of withdrawal. When the formula was changed, the symptoms went away. Child Protective Service placed the baby into custody of Thomas' father, that's Dan Cooper. On February 7th, Tama and Gideon had their baby returned and the case was closed. Tama had agreed to a service plan with home visits by the county health nurse and counseling at the parents' center. While these seem very reasonable measures, there are reports of information obtained at these sessions turning into more charges by Child Protective Services against the women receiving the counseling. Tama and Gideon knew that if they were still homeless when the baby was born, they greatly risked losing their child to Child Protective Services. But Tama was able to find housing, a modest one-bedroom trailer with a kitchen, shower, bath, electricity, and heat in a legal park connected to the sewer system. She thought she was home free. But a week before Tama delivered, a neighbor at the trailer park came to her. "Be careful," she warned. "Watch out for CPS. They come here a lot. They took my baby away." Although she was haunted by the woman's words, Tama discounted the danger. "I thought there must have been some reason why they did it to her." Child Protective Services works behind a shield of secrecy. Families are not allowed to see their files. Court proceedings allow no witnesses and are not public. No tape recordings of the proceedings are allowed. In most cases, the mothers are not even accused of a crime, hence they have no right to a public defender, to a jury trial, or even to face their accusers. According to Dan Brennan, a father who is fighting to regain custody of his daughter in the Santa Cruz family law system, Child Protective Service has no motivation to find these mothers to be adequate. It creates a conflict of interest for them, Brennan said. As long as the child is placed, that agency receives funding for that child. $122 a day. They pay a typical foster mother $500 a month. The rest of the money can go to pay their salaries, office furniture, phones, or to hire new employees to go out and ferret out more abuse. I believe it is now $47,000 per child Child Protective Services gets if they can declare a baby adoptable. The Bill of Rights guarantees a quick and speedy trial, the right to cross-examine our accusers, that the punishment must fit the crime, and that one is innocent until proven guilty. I believe that in the last 10 years we have seen all of these rights seriously eroded. CPS operates under a veil of secrecy. I believe all their records should become public. Governor Pete Wilson, when confronted with accusations that massive AFDC cuts would cause mothers to be unable to provide for their children, replied that, quote, "Welfare mothers really have a responsibility to a child and to taxpayers, and that giving up the child they don't have the means to support might be the best for both the child and for taxpayers." According to Richard Harrington, a paralegal who works on custody cases, "Our Supreme Court has ruled that the most fundamental of these basic rights of liberty is the right of people to sire, to bear, and to raise their own children as they see fit, unless any reasonable person would say they were clearly being abusive or neglectful towards their children's rights. A concomitant right is the right of the children, again, apart from clearly abusive or neglectful situations, to know, to be with daily and continuously, and to be raised by both of their own parents with all their faults and inadequacies. While this is the law of the land, CPS has its own law." In an official statement reminiscent of Nixon's refusal to give out information on public agencies for reasons of national security, CPS maintains its secrecy to protect the children. But in a system where there are no checks and balances, where each placement financially rewards the placers, no baby is safe, and no mother, especially if she is poor or homeless, can give birth without fear of the agency whose stated purpose is to protect and serve her children. Is it legal for Child Protective Services to take a child solely because the parent is homeless or underhoused? According to Linda LeMaster, chair of the Santa Cruz Commission for the Prevention of Violence Against Women and longtime welfare rights advocate, the answer is no, at least not legally. LeMaster explained, California made an out-of-court agreement with the Western Center on Law and Poverty's lawyers, which led to our state's AFDC Homeless Assistance Program. This program provides for security deposits to AFDC-eligible families who are homeless. When AFDC Homeless Assistance was created to prevent the lawsuits going to court, California Department of Social Services was admitting to their habit of seizing children because from their parents solely because of homelessness. The state, in making this backroom deal, also promised to cease and desist tearing families apart where homelessness is their only excuse. Unquote. In many cases, a family in crisis could, with a little support, resolve the crisis and stay together. A family at risk of homelessness often just needs help with housing, but CPS doesn't help houseless families find homes. They remove their children and place them in foster homes as a matter of public policy. In virtually every case, this is done to the detriment of the family and at far greater public expense. Tama found a clue as to why CPS had picked her out. I saw the mobile home park I now live in mentioned in a brochure the county gives out, listing services for homeless people. The brochure names food services, where to get clothing, counseling, etc. Under the section marked shelters is our trailer park. Undoubtedly, in some CPS file, which neither Tama nor any other member of the public will ever see, under housing, the worker has written, lives in a shelter. And that was from an article, The Lost Children of the Poor, printed in Street Spirit, March 1997. On this upcoming show, Thursday's show on Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides, we will announce... apparently there was a memorial for Tama because of the pouring rains and deluge and storms, many people were unable to attend. And I spoke with Dan Cooper, Tama's father, this morning, and he said that he would like to schedule a second memorial for Tama Pearlman. So please listen on Thursday between 6 and 8 p.m., and we will make the announcement when and where that memorial will be. Tama Pearlman, age 24, died January 27th, 98.
And that was Becky Johnson you were listening to. Perhaps we can persuade Becky to stay in the studio a little while to ask her a few more questions about some other subjects. If you didn't catch all of this and you're interested in Tama, you can always give a call to the Huff line, 423-HUFF, for more information. And, for example, if you missed the Thursday's edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides from 6 to 8 and want to find out when the new memorial is scheduled for, do give a call to 423-HUFF. Maybe we can even put it on the outgoing message. It's Free Radio Santa Cruz you're listening to at 96.3 FM, the 24-hour station that has stuff you will not hear anywhere else, I can guarantee. And we are struggling along. We can use all kinds of support, financial and otherwise. And we can also use your involvement as a community member. If you want to help out, give us a call at 427-4523. And let us know what you think you can do, and if we can help you out in terms of public service announcements. If you got stuff you want to put on the air, do give us a call, the same number, 427-4523. Want to remind folks who are interested in city council meetings that there is no meeting on Tuesday. Probably a week from Tuesday is the next city council meeting. for those of you who like to follow such things. I think there's a meeting of Amnesty International on Tuesday at some point, according to our Sunday Sentinel, which is always a questionable source, but can serve at least as a sort of an interesting debating point. Well, we have Becky Johnson here in the studio. Maybe we can grill her a bit on what's been happening in other areas. I know, Becky, you're a board member for the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, which is the group that runs emergency shelter in our town, the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program, which still using the armory, I guess, and the floor of the armory for people to use as emergency shelter. Indeed, it only shelters, of course, I would say less than a tenth of the people in Santa Cruz who are outside and under the domain of the anti-homeless Santa Cruz sleeping ban. And I guess we're also hoping to have another board member from CCH here or later, the outspoken Laura Tucker, Tough Love Tucker, as I call her, just as I occasionally slander you with the name Beggarbacker Becky. Do you have any kind of more general report, Becky, you'd like to make on stuff that's been happening in homeless rights issues that you think folks might want to know about?
Well, Robert, as you know, I work on a number of different areas regarding homeless issues. I've been following closely the Pelton Street, the sale of that property by the city to a private developer, effectively ripping out the heart of the Homeless Garden Project over great public protest, and in spite of an initiative that filed their signatures with the city clerk 4 days before escrow cleared. Last we heard, it was 5,600 signatures. They only needed 3,800. It was most certainly going to qualify for the ballot, and yet city council sold the property. Anyway.
What did Citizens Committee for the Homeless have to say about that? I understand that even though you weren't at the last board meeting, you have a kind of a direct line into them. Were they concerned that the city council had done an end run around one of their oldest projects?
I think privately, most members of the Citizens Committee for the Homeless and people who are more active in the Homeless Garden Project despaired over these actions of city council. However, the board found publicly that they needed to take a different position and never did endorse the initiative circulated by the Friends of the Pelton Street Garden.
Just as they have not yet endorsed the sleeping ban initiative. In fact, they've kind of edged away from it, right?
That's correct. The reasoning given was that the Homeless Garden Project had leased the land from the city with the understanding that it was only temporary and that at some point that the ability to use that property would end, and they felt that they would be disrespectful to the city if they actively engaged in opposing the moving, even through the initiative process, which I personally believe would have been quite proper. It's certainly a legal and proper way to affect change. But however, that was not the position of Citizens Committee for the Homeless. I think that the sleeping ban initiative, the reason that CCH has been so reluctant, including HCR's Homeless Community Resource Center, also has not endorsed the initiative locally. And I believe that is for a similar reason. They're afraid of offending certain city council members who they know or hold a different view and for whom they frequently get funding. I think that's probably the real concern, although the stated reason why that they did not support the initiative was that they felt that it would possibly impact their 501c nonprofit status if they endorsed their initiative.
Now, you also have worked, Becky, with the Santa Cruzans for Full Disclosure, which is a group that I guess hasn't met recently, but some of the members are still calling in and concerned about the case of Happy John Dine, who was shot by the police. We mentioned him earlier, killed by the police in the show. We mentioned that earlier in the show. Has anything new happened around that issue that you're aware of? I know that you sent a letter to the Citizens Police Review Board after they had their findings that upheld, essentially dismissed the complaints. Anything happening around that?
Well, I did attempt to speak to board member Alan Lang. I spoke to him briefly and attempted to arrange a meeting with him to analyze how the CPRB came to the conclusion it did and how they dealt with some other rather sticky issues that that were not mentioned in the findings of the CPRB. For instance, allegations that Officer Martin Over, after John Dine had been shot, went and unzipped his fanny pack and took out the toy gun and threw it on the ground, which several witnesses saw something that looked very much like that. Or why the CPRB did not make any critical comments to Chief Belcher and the Santa Cruz Police Department for concluding and issuing a press release saying that John Dine had been in a combat position, that he had a toy gun in his hand pointed at the police officers, and that he had refused to respond in clear instructions given him by the police officers to freeze or to not move. All of those are very much disputed by the police records, but they don't want to talk about it. They want to check and see if it's okay to talk about it.
Right. There is essentially silence on the issue. More important, there is no general consideration of real issues coming out of this. That even if you believe the officer, you know, panicked and shot Kerry because he thought, I mean, Kerry shot Dine because he thought that Dine had a real weapon, and you know that it was an understandable mistake. The question of the procedures of shooting to kill, the question of approaching with your guns drawn instead of from behind a squad car, which apparently is another process that's used, the question of whether this is linked up with any kind of anti-homeless mentality that's going on in terms of these particular officers' background and the orders issued to officers on the mall. None of these issues were considered by the CPRB worthy of forwarding to the police department or the city council. Now, apropos of this, I actually had an interview with Gary Yamane, who is the staff member of the Citizens Police Review Board. I met with him last week and interviewed him. I think it was Wednesday or Tuesday, something like that. I'm going to play that interview now. And I want you to give me your reactions, Becky, to what you hear him saying. Actually, Gary has been very friendly in the past, very forthcoming, very willing to be interviewed on issues around police review. But recently he's become much more reticent and defensive, perhaps because he feels that somehow we should just let this issue lie, and by continuing to raise it, we are somehow making ourselves ridiculous or making him ridiculous. I happen to feel the issue is completely unresolved, and until I hear clarifications as to what the internal processes of the board were about why they chose to disregard every non-police witness and essentially accept police witnesses, other than the rather shallow comments that, well, they were closer. I can't really credit Yamane's attempt to dismiss all this. I'm sorry, go ahead, Ben.
Yeah, I found that there's still an awful lot of interest in this case on the street, and the people I've talked to, nobody other than City Council seems satisfied with the findings of the CPRB, and indeed an article just recently came out in the Socialist Action.
We interviewed actually Steve Argyll last show, or was it the show before, the author of that article, and also if you want to follow this further, if you look at the latest City on a Hill Press, you'll see a column by me, a rather some ways garbled column, and it's not as garbled as I'd feared. It's okay. We actually wrote a second draft that the City on a Hill Press didn't want to take because it didn't have time. But check it out. It's in the current issue of City on a Hill Press on John Dine. It's in the Writing on the Wall section. And they also have an interesting article on the sleeping ban as well, the debate up on campus. But go ahead, Becky, you were saying.
John Dine may be dead, but I don't think the John Dine case is dead in people's minds in Santa Cruz.
Well, let's hear now what Gary Yamane had to say. We talked about a variety of subjects. We certainly covered the Dine case a bit, and here's that interview.
Okay, we're talking to Gary Yamane, who's staff person for the Santa Cruz Citizens Police Review Board. Hi, Gary.
Hello, Robert.
So you're on the job here. You're actually present at all the meetings, not just the public ones, but the closed meetings of the CPRB.
Correct.
And you're kind of the keeper of the files, and your office is open 9 to 1 every Monday through Thursday here at 915 Cedar Street.
Yes.
You also take complaints by phone 24 hours a day and respond to calls from folks who say can't come in during the business hour?
Of course. Our phone number is 429-3262. People can feel free to leave a message. We will get back to you either by phone, or if you leave an address, we will send out a complaint form if that's what you're needing. And we provide a stamped self-addressed envelope to return the complaint, so it doesn't even cost you anything.
Lose that envelope and send a letter to a friend, actually, if you feel the board is useless.
A lot, actually, Robert.
Yes. Well, you know the latest case, of course, and the most controversial one has been the Happy John Dine slaying, and I guess, what, 7 complaints generated by that slaying?
Yes.
And these were complaints against Officer Carey for excessive force, maybe against Officer Over for misstating information, and Officer Chief Belcher for misrepresenting the case publicly, or perhaps for covering up information. You recall this set of complaints?
Yes, I do.
And the board, of course, went through some extensive, for considering in terms of its past action on other cases, analysis of these cases. It actually sought new information from the police department, namely the dispatcher tape, I believe. Was there other new information that it requested in terms, and you can describe in a general sense that it sought that was not in the library, for instance, in the district attorney's report that was released?
Well, in addition to reviewing the DA's investigation, there was the internal affairs investigation.
But I think you told me that internal affairs investigation was not much bulkier. I mean, it was like 10% the bulk of the entire DA's report. That it wasn't, let's say, it was a small fraction of the number of pages of that which had already been released publicly. Is that accurate?
That's correct.
And of course, there was one crucial bit of information that we discussed a couple of weeks ago, namely the dispatcher tape, the radio tape of the conversations between officers Over and Carey and the police headquarters around the time of the shooting. When we attempted to get a copy of that tape, we got silence and I guess a few comments after the shooting, no doubt part of the theory that that's part of the officer's personnel file or the internal affairs document, something around those lines.
The only thing I can think of, Robert, is why you got a different tape than what we heard is because what was publicly released in the DA file, I assume that the tape had to match that transcription and not more than that. So that's my only thinking of why what you got as a dispatch tape is different than what the board heard.
Well, I don't think the DA's file actually even mentions the transcription. There is no transcription that I can remember in the DA's report. And that, in fact, that omission really struck us when we read that report. And so we sought to get a copy of the tape through Attorney Ed Fry. He, after some dialogue with Police Chief Belcher, got the tape. And then when we played it, we were, of course, dumbfounded to find that it was completely silent to the relevant period, immediately before and immediately after the shooting. Since the question was, did in fact the police receive word that a man was brandishing a gun? Did they turn that information in? This is data that apparently your board had access to that the public does not.
Apparently so.
Now, we have requested, and this will come out in a letter to City on a Hill, hopefully on Friday, that the police chief, the officers involved, the Police Officers Association, agree voluntarily to release this tape to the public and waive confidentiality. Is it your sense that this is something that they can appropriately do if they all agree to do that?
I think the chief can do, the Police Officers Association might oppose the idea, but if the chief and the officers want to release that information, I don't see why they can't.
I mean, the theory is if officers Over and Carey have nothing to hide,
why shouldn't the tape be released to the public if they agree to it?
Good question. I mean, it could be, I suppose, if they agree to it. You'd have to talk to the chief because it's not my tape. So.
Well, I'm going to write a letter to him directly requesting it. I haven't turned in complaints, or should I say, I haven't turned in report copies of my, maybe I did turn in a copy of, several officers have actually been helpful to me in the last 2 months, which is a positive thing, and I've reported it to the police chief and to the mayor, and I think I even left a copy with the CPRB at one point, although your job is not to, you know, get testimonials for the police officers. I'm sure they can do that through another department. So maybe Chief Belcher will take a more positive view. I don't know. We'll see. I talked to you earlier today about, I guess, a concern that some of us have developed. We of course, were very, at the Santa Cruzans, for full disclosure, group concerned with the Happy John Dine slang, really concerned that the CPRB refused to hold any public hearings. That even was, just to us, more important than an independent investigation, because it would have aired the process and put the witnesses in a position where they could be questioned by people who were less, shall we say, well, less connected with police agencies, and so give more credibility to the questions that were asked, and also allow for an opportunity to ask questions that were not asked by the police department and by the district attorney's office of witnesses in the Happy John Dine slang. And the CPRB apparently made a decision not to allow public hearings and not to even and have an independent investigation. Did it have a formal vote on this issue?
I'm thinking back. Did they vote on it? It seemed like it was consensus agreement. It seemed like the topics of both the independent investigation and the calling a public hearing to take testimony directly from witnesses and officers was discussed at length in several meetings.
But you don't recall a formal vote?
No, I don't recall any formal vote on either of those. I think there was there were no motions to, nobody made a motion to have either of those. So if there was no motion, then there was no vote. That's my recollection. But
at these meetings, there were five hearings. Two of them, one of them a press conference, one of them, a, I guess you might call, a lot of public testimony at a public hearing, the December 8th or 9th meeting of the CPRB. And then there were three closed hearings on the Dine case. Is that correct?
That's my recollection, yeah.
And at those closed hearings, which is where most of the information was actually, in fact, those are the only place where the information was actually discussed by the board, Alan Lang was not present for two of those meetings, the first two. Is that correct?
No, I don't think that's correct. He missed the December public meeting,